Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 237 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
And we have Jaime Lopez Jr., who is currently in Tokyo Nihonbashi region, Japan.
How's it going?
Going pretty good.
So Jaime, what city are you in now? Are you in Tokyo?
Yes, in the Nihonbashi area. It seems to be a central business district.
Have you seen much of Japan, or you just kind of landed in Tokyo International Airport or whatever, and there you are?
I haven't gone outside of Tokyo. It's such a short trip, just a week. The travel time between destinations was something I thought about, and I said, well, I've never been to Tokyo, so I can visit a whole bunch of the different, I don't even know what they call them. I'm going to call them neighborhoods, because it's like an American thing to call it. Like the neighborhood regions, like Shinjuku, Shibuya, Akihabara, all those different sort of, like, you probably remember the names because you heard it somewhere online, sort of thing. and just like looking up, hey, top 10 things to do, and then doing some of those things. So I've stayed completely within the boundaries of Tokyo just for this short trip. And I still feel like I probably haven't seen anywhere near all of it. I've only seen like the top 10 list, touristy type list for each of the different regions.
Alrighty, so we don't have just to put a fact check note on here. Last week I was talking, and I'm yelling at myself in the phone because I knew when I said that the LEM stands for Lunar Excursion Module, but they just call it LEM for short, or Lunar Module sometimes. But I don't know what I said last week, but it was completely wrong. So anyway, apologies for that.
We know what you meant.
But I think I said Evacuation Module or something ridiculous like that. Mm. Oh, by the way, by now, by the time this recording comes out, it may be too late, but I went and saw Apollo 11 on the IMAX on Saturday with like several members of my family, and it is amazing. So it's apparently in the theaters, in IMAX theaters, until March 7th, which is tomorrow. So if you haven't seen it already, you lose. But yeah, if you can, go see it. Like, it's jaw-dropping. You won't take your eyes off the screen for the entire time. It's only 90 minutes long, too. So great, great movie. And it's not a lot of voiceover and stuff like that. So it's very, very, very compelling. And it's getting, like you said, I think you said last week, Mark, what is it, 100%?
About 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
It's pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm. It'll probably win for best documentary at the Oscars next year. Let's hope so. All right. So, Jaime, do we have any Ask NTJC? Have you had a look?
We do. We've got a couple. The first one is from Mike Hendley and says, with regard to your last show, we have some very smart folks who I work making excellent use of VR. Not HoloLens AR in this case, but it is exciting to see this kind of tech moving into healthcare. And he is helpfully giving us a link for the show notes for those of you driving at home about a 3D virtual reality system that helps neurosurgeons treat Parkinson's by seeing a virtual version of the patient's brain, and so they can better understand the patient's particular challenges and see it without having to like cut the person open. I assume this is based off of the not the CAT scan, the MRI. Mm-hmm. So that seems pretty cool.
Do you have any more?
The other one is from a friend of the show and sometimes former co-host, now engineer at a big fruit company, Greg Hio. I was going to call him Gregory Archibald Hio, and I couldn't help myself, and I stopped halfway. You don't know Greg, and if you don't, welcome to the show. Greg is one of our friends.
On Roundabout, we were calling him Greg who? Yeah,
anyway, too bad he's sorry. Too bad he's not a doctor. So he says the closest TFSA equivalent is a Roth IRA, post-tax contributions, no tax on withdrawal. The American host should know what it is. And that's a reference to our discussion of Canadian and American retirement account stuff. So a TFSA in the USA is a Roth IRA.
Yeah, and I think one thing I probably should have said last week about the TFSAs, I think you can contribute roughly $5,000 per year to them. They're not you know, big-time saving things, but they're handy for tucking away some money. Well, there is one more Ask MTGC too, Jaime, you might have missed it, from Paul Wilco. Paul Wilkinson, who's Paul Wilco on Twitter, he said that he just checked his Apple Watch and he said it definitely needs to be unlocked to unlock his Mac. So I'm pretty sure Sam Grover had said that he were able to do it without. So your mileage will vary on that one.
Yeah, I wonder if that changed over time or if that's some sort of setting that might be different. You know, like how Face ID has the, you can be the super secure, like you actually have to be looking at the phone, not just, you know, phone scanning your face. But some people turn that off so it's a little bit more convenient when they're using the phone and it's laying on their desk or something. I wonder if it's that sort of situation where it's like a setting. I have to admit, I have not checked into this to see because my old school MacBook Pro that I'm desperately looking to replace, if Apple should release something in the next month or so, does not support the unlock with a watch, so I can't actually check it out myself. Yeah, it's slightly too old. It's literally the last or the first model that does not support it when you go back in time.
Well, my 2013 MacBook Air works with it pretty well. The one thing about it, I mean, like, you know, so my phone is set to unlock my watch, right? So, or I guess, like, you know, if my watch tells me, you know, I can enter the passcode. If I took it off my wrist right now, it immediately locks. And if you put it on your wrist, it would you know, require a password to unlock it. But if I picked up my phone, like if you were being like nefarious or whatever, and I picked up my phone and I started looking at Twitter or whatever, the action of unlocking my phone would unlock my watch. And therefore, you could walk over to my Mac and, you know, when I'm not paying attention and, you know, send some evil emails or something, or download those files onto that USB stick we talked about last week. All right. So, I mean, like, I suppose technically there's got to be a way to lock it, but, and I mean, like, it's not flawless. Like, I think there's a certain time up period. I don't know specifically what it is. Like, you know how Face ID and Touch ID, they were after a certain period of time, no matter what, they will ask you for your passcode because it's been like so many days, you know, since they checked you or whatever. So yeah,
right.
There's probably some limits like that in there. All right. So on the follow up, my first follow up here is that just basically the Apple sent out, you know, we talked last week about that email that came to the podcasters telling us about adding episode numbers. And I went to, you know, Dan Benjamin, asked him about that on Slack, and he contacted somebody at Apple, and, you know, there was some tweets going back and forth with fellow podcasters. And then a couple of days later, Apple sent us a "we're sorry" email, basically saying that they were just trying to advise us on how to best create titles for our things, and that they wouldn't quote, I'm doing air quotes, remove our show because of a violation like that. But somebody didn't point out on Twitter that you know, all the developers out there know that, like, you break a rule in the submissions, and, you know, you're going to get bounced from the store, not removed from the store, but you may not get approved or whatever. So we're a little gun shy on that that front when Apple sends out these warnings to us, right?
Yeah, I think the reputation of the company for how it tends to operate is something really important. And in all fairness, like, I'm sure it is completely different people that are involved with the iTunes podcast type stuff versus App Store review, but for folks who do crossover, like you mentioned, like we do, I can totally understand why people were a little twitchy about some random new rule coming out and just assuming that they were going to lay down the hammer as they do in the App Store review process. And so I completely understand that people were scared. I mean, it's different in terms of impact because, you know, as much as it would suck to not be in the iTunes directory, that is just a directory. It's not as if it hosts any of the podcasts, such as this very podcast itself. So there still are other routes by which people could subscribe and listen to our show. But it's in contrast to, you know, getting kicked out of the App Store, and in the worst possible case, they reject your developer certificate, and then I guess you're open sourcing and having people download your app separately just for giggles. I can understand why people were very afraid of, like, please don't kill my podcast sort of thing for something that seemed relatively trivial. Like, well, okay, what does it matter if we put, you know, episode 237 in the title? We've done that for a long time, or it's helpful for people to understand where they're at. I get where Apple's coming from in terms of it kind of looks weird in the UI to see their number one, number two, number three is 237, 236, 235. And it's like, what? This is sorted wrong. What's happening here? I completely get where they're coming from. It is a shame that we're sort of overly sensitive because of history with the App Store review process. So I feel really sorry for the iTunes podcast directory folks who, I'm guessing, had no idea how their terminology or their phrasing was going to be interpreted.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I think Apple's a bit guilty of some navel gazing because, you know, I've been to the podcast page on iTunes, and discovery is just, it's 10 times worse than it is on the App Store. Like, there's, you know, unless you know specifically which category, I mean, the categories aren't that well defined, and, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And they also have, they had to do a bit of editorializing by, you know, putting up the most popular podcasts. And I think that, I don't know, just these algorithms that try to decide what you'd be interested in. I think, I don't know if it's written by an algorithm or there's a person there handpicking the new and notable stuff. I mean, you know, we've sort of been thrown into, like, we're like a snowflake in a snowstorm, or like, what did they say on Star Trek the other day? A grain of sand in a hurricane or something like that.
Right.
We're just kind of thrown into the thing, and yet we've risen up to through people, you know, liking our show and you know, listening to it, and I guess some of the metadata that we put into our description, we've risen to the top of the iOS development podcast. But we still don't show up if you go over to, I mean, if you do the search, we show up, sure, but if you just go in and just want to troll around and look and see what's on Apple Podcasts page or site or whatever you want to call it, where you wouldn't find us, right? So, you know, so I don't know that it's all that important at the end of the day what we put in our titles. You know, people are going to find us, you know, through tools like Overcast or whatever, word of mouth, and they're going to subscribe. And, you know, because I don't know how 2,000 people or whatever it is, you know, per week listen to us, how they find us. I have no clue. And Apple certainly isn't sharing that information with me.
Yeah. I do think the flip side of this, though, is that it's been helpful for openness and ease of interoperability. Like, you know, if you don't like the Apple Podcasts app, you can very easily export what you want and import that into Overcast or Pocket Casts or Castro and like a million other different podcast apps. And so the flip side of Apple being relatively quiet and not doing a whole lot in this area is that they have allowed the industry room to grow and breathe. And I worry a little bit that if they get a little too interested, I don't want them to go down the route of like what Spotify and others are trying to, Stitcher and all these other ones trying to do, to like close the environment where you can pretty much just listen to content through their particular apps rather than having it be, hey, it's an RSS feed and you subscribe whatever, whenever and with whatever application you want to use.
But hopefully they don't go into the, oh, you might be interested in listening to this kind of nonsense we see in other social networks and things like that, right? We're happy to have the people who are listening to us. Thanks for listening to the show. We really do appreciate it. We do this for you guys, for your love. Let's move on. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. This is another follow-up item on the bug bounty, that there is no macOS bug bounty. And there was a security researcher who had found a keychain bug, and he demonstrated it and that kind of stuff. He just, you know, even he was kind of holding out, I think, for the, I think you mentioned this last week, Hami. He was holding out for some sort of recognition or bug bounty or something like that from Apple. There is one on iOS per se, but there isn't one on the Mac. So he finally did, he handed over the information he had on how to, and he's got a video here demonstrating how you basically can get a password out of the keychain through some skullduggery. He wrote a little demo app that shows how to go in and read the keychain items without authentication in GET. Because you can go in and, you know, the Mac keychain, and you can authenticate and see what the password is, but he's found a way to do it without that. So hopefully Apple will get that patched up soon, but in the meantime, there should be something about the bug bounty. And I think I read something in this article I have posted here about the fact that the iOS bug bounty hasn't actually, I mean, it's it's not as simple as reporting a bug and getting paid. It's kind of like you have to do a fair bit of work to get the recognition. Are you guys familiar with the iOS bug bounty at all?
Not too much. Why don't you tell us about it, Tim?
Well, I'm just looking here. I think it's the last line here. It says, while Apple does have a bug bounty for researchers who find security problems in iOS, even that has been called stingy compared to other firms. And it leads to another article from earlier last, or 2017, about a bit more detail on Apple's bug bounty. It doesn't often pay out that often.
Seem to have a maximum payout of $200,000, which doesn't sound bad, but it doesn't mean that they actually pay that very often.
Well, it's like, I don't know if you've ever heard about the used to have this thing called the software police, where, you know, if you illegally installed a copy of a Microsoft product or an Adobe product, you know, that there have been whistleblower programs where, you know, if you blow the whistle on someone who, you know, who's illegally downloading apps and installing them on their computers, you know, there's like a pick a number, any number kind of reward. But I do know that the only time they pay out is if it actually leads to a conviction. So, and you know, that proving those kind of things is awfully hard. And nine times out of 10, the companies that chase these guys are just looking for some sort of settlement anyway. And it's not the companies, like it's not Microsoft or Adobe that are doing the actual chasing. It's usually some legal firm that's doing it. Mm-hmm. So these kind of bounties are, you know, they're not a payday, you know?
Well, actually in the same article, it says private companies like Zerodium pay upward of $1.5 million for a full set of bugs that can jailbreak an iPhone, the report says.
Right. Yeah, that's the other side of it.
Other firms will accept iOS exploits for $500,000, depending on their intrinsic value. Yeah,
there's a market for it.
There's a market for it, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that what was described there as stinginess. I'm a little surprised that they do it. Like, I understand that, what is this, a race to the top? Excuse the opposite of a race to the bottom.
Race to the bottom, yeah.
You know, let's say, for giggles and grins, they say, all right, $1 million, or what was the highest one? You said $1.5 million. All right, we're going to make it $2 million. You are incentivized to give that to Apple. That would help, but it would also not help in all cases, because we've talked about in the show the other entities who don't really care about that sort of budgeting. You know, we're talking large government entities can easily pay more than that if it's something that will get them access to a high profile target that they're looking to hack, right? So I don't understand why Apple doesn't just align their payments with the rest of the industry, with what like Google and Microsoft are offering. Just, you know, just peg it or pin it to the same value and say, all right, you know, we're roughly in the same area. And I'm very surprised that they're stingy on the side of like not having a macOS. Like, what does it even matter? It should just be, if we have an Apple product, and I guess it's, you know, within some reasonable amount of freshness, like for support, why don't they just offer the bug bounty program across the board? Like, why is iOS sort of the favorite child here and not tvOS and watchOS?
So I have my theory on that, and I think it's because of the size of the market, potential market, and the potential for loss. I think the iOS market, the number of iPhone devices that are out there, like eclipses how many Macs are out there per se. And, you know, the potential to lose, you know, critical information on a Mac, I think, is a lot lower than would be if you were able to exploit people's iPhones, you know, because you can get contact databases, you can get, you know, passwords, you can get banking information. You know, people don't load a banking app onto their Mac yet. Maybe Marzipan will change that, you know?
Yes, they do.
They have like specific macOS binaries that run this, or they're talking, I'm not talking about browser.
Specific banks, but I use banking software that will let me log into my various bank accounts and it stores the passwords within the application. That so I don't need to type password in myself. I can just log into my account and pull down all my information.
Sure, yeah.
So that info is there. But I do agree. Not to argue your main point though, that absolutely the size of the iOS market is just eclipses the size of the Mac OS market. And not only in amount of usage, but in mind share and importance to Apple as a company. If it ever got out that iPhones got hacked on a large scale, that would be just a complete disaster for Apple.
Yeah, yeah, and Google too. To be honest with you, like same thing there,
yep.
Right?
Yep, true.
I mean, I guess those reasons make sense to me as to why they specifically chose that. I'm just coming back to the stinginess. I'm surprised that a company as successful economically as Apple would even have to like decide whether or not it would have pizza parties on Friday or a bug bounty program for macOS. Right? I'm being very facetious here, but
yeah.
It seems like they're not, you know, hurting for cash, and that I don't think it would be a huge outlay for macOS, given the things that we just talked about.
Yep. Maybe there's some history to it too, because historically the Mac was much more secure than other operating systems to this kind of issue. So maybe they built up a culture of not feeling that they need that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true. I think that may be the case. But yeah, and it's the ubiquity of the smartphone devices that are out there, right? So, mm-hmm. People are spending, there's all kinds of statistics on the amount of time you're using on your phones these days. That's, Apple's even added an app to tell you how much time you're spending on your phones where compared to your Macs kind of thing, right? Anyway, next story here is I don't know if you guys heard today or the last couple of days that Facebook, we talked about Facebook and Apple having a new stance on privacy and encryption, but there was some comments earlier today. I think maybe Zuckerberg might have got up and said something about it. And of course, I saw one of the tweets coming back about, with what Facebook has been doing with our information, where the customer is the business, or our, the users are the business. They're questioning whether their new stance on privacy and encryption. But that leads me to this story that I found earlier this week that apparently Facebook, has been allowing you to use two-factor authentication on your phone, on your device, using your phone number to prove that, as the second factor, and then turning around and doling out those numbers, those phone numbers, to their clients. So it's kind of like you're trusting Facebook with this critical piece of information that, like your, in this case here, your SMS number, to be used for your security, and they're doling that out to, according to Fast Company here, they're doling that out to third parties, right?
Yeah. It's almost like they don't, I don't know whether they don't care or they're not paying attention, or it's sort of hard to believe, but it seems to be what they're doing. It's almost too mind-boggling to even imagine.
Yeah. Well, the comment here is, and Facebook won't let users opt out of this privacy violation that they never opted into.
Yeah.
So I think my take on this is definitely Facebook has some interesting cultural problems to deal with in order to avoid this sort of thing happening. But I think it's very similar to what we just talked about for Apple, where the podcast review team didn't realize what normally happens on the App Store review team, and so they were completely unaware of how their words were going to be interpreted. I think here, what I would guess without knowing any information at all, is Dollars to Donuts says there's a team that did the 2FA stuff, there's phone numbers in there. For whatever reason, they didn't secure API access or database access to that information. So a completely different random set of engineers are like, hey, we want to do this thing to make it easier to find people. What do you have? Oh, you have phone numbers in your contact list, right? Let's make an easy way to, this is in the database, we can access that. And I think that's why you can't opt out, because nobody was like, they're like, hey, well, hey, Jaime's phone number is 1234567, we can make access to that. Why not do that? And I think it was probably not nefarious reasons, but just sort of lack of competence and core values around protecting that sort of information. Like, I couldn't imagine Apple doing this, for example, right? That's not the way they roll. But I could see how, for completely innocent reasons, this huge security screw up happens.
Yeah, well, I've been bugged by Facebook, to add a phone number to the more than just code page and the Sparkcast page, and I kind of wondered about that, why are they doing this? And look at this, there's my phone number right there. How about that? Well, and they're sort of saying that people can look you up by this by looking for your phone number now, crazy. I think there was something that came up the other day from one of these networks. I think it was Facebook asking we can make it much more easier by just slurping your contact into here, so you can help you find your friends on Facebook. I think we said this 3 or 4 years ago. No, thank you very much. Anyway.
So I am now at the moment on Facebook changing my privacy settings.
That's another reason why you go to Facebook.
Friends. Yeah. At least you change the privacy to friends, so only your friends can look you up.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was actually just in there myself looking. This is under settings, right?
Who can see your friends list? Public. That means everyone can.
Privacy. Yeah. See, Mark, you don't spend enough time here. They keep changing these things. This is the thing about Facebook,
Well, this is one reason I don't use it, is because of this kind of stuff.
Who can send you friends requests? Everyone can send me friend requests. So let's change that to
It might have been just last week. I don't know. We've talked about this quarter quite a bit, but this gets at the heart of what we've said here, where data is a liability. You should try to collect as little of it as possible because bad things can happen. And I think this is a shining example of data was collected for ostensibly a good reason, and bad things happen as a result. So you got to be careful, even in, you know, at the indie level all the way up to the giant corporate behemoth level. It's not an easy problem to solve, other than, I guess, not collecting it at all. And then your problem is very easy.
Yeah, I'm just changing my privacy settings myself. Oh, Facebook, you make me laugh. And the sad part about it is, like, in our case, our family, we use it to keep in touch with our family. Like, you know, I have relatives in Europe and Asia and you know, across Canada as well, right? I also want to know what Jaime's doing on the weekend, too. That's very important.
My disgruntled rumblings about local ISPs and how their stuff does or does not work for people visiting this fine country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were earlier today, earlier in the broadcast before we started recording, we were talking about some code issues. And, you know, we don't talk about code. We do talk about code, but we don't talk about it all that much. But I just wanted to talk about a story that I've just come across yesterday, actually. I was in the process of the catalyst for this was my web provider changed my PHP to PHP 7, which broke a whole bunch of APIs for me. So I had to go through and rewrite some of my API calls. And so I spent a weekend doing that. And so as I did that, came back to the apps that use those APIs, I've been looking at things in the apps and going, oh, well, this bothers me. So I went in and fixed a few things. One of the things I'm doing is setting up some of the apps to work with the iPhone 10 series of phones, or the 10, the 10R and 10S, which of course, because of the sensor area, otherwise known as the notch, use this new safe area thing. And so, you know, some of my code is still in Objective-C, as I mentioned before. And one app in particular, I haven't done any Swift in. So I was just going through and looking at this one particular table view that I was having trouble fitting onto the iPhone 10. Like, in other words, it was going down into that chin area. You know, you have that little home indicator. You're supposed to stay away from that. So because people are going to swipe up and down there, right? Mm-hmm. And I had some interaction I wanted to have down there, and it, for some reason, wasn't working. So I went back into that view controller and looked around, and it was built on a bunch of different things. But one of the things on there was a table view, and below that was like a little handmade toolbar with a text field in it that you could enter text in, and it would update the table view, right? But so then I thought, well, you know, I'm having trouble with this, and why don't I just look up safe area, right? So I thought, well, okay, let's see. This was not built. This was built in the old days when we did it in it with frame, and you know, you'd figure out what the size of the view was, and you'd basically build your table view in code. And again, table views are like they're older than dirt on iPhone. Like I think Mark was saying, wasn't the first OS sort of thing was table views back in old phone OS days?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, back in iPhone OS before it was even iOS, you know, I think iPhone OS 2, you know, table views were kind of the thing. That was the
and they kind of just worked, right? You just set one up, gave it some data and gave it a data source and set the delegates up, and you kind of got a table view for free. No, you know, special gymnastics or not even, you could even do it without even visiting Interface Builder, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you made it a table view controller, you got all that sort of UI for free. So here, in this case here, it's a standard view controller that I've put a table view into in code. And I thought, well, here's an exercise for me. Let me go and try and find out how to do safe area in Objective-C in code, mm-hmm. right? And of course, it's almost like going back to 2010, because there is no documentation on it. I mean, there's the Apple documentation on it, but you kind of got to read through it and do that. And then, of course, I had to decide, you know, I have to be able to support the non-10 series phones. So I have to have, you know, the trailing and leading and top and bottom constraints. And then for anything that supports iOS 11 and up, I can add in the safe area, right? So, and what happened was, so I had this little if statement with the four sets of constraints in there. And for some reason, when I did the same kind of thing, I couldn't figure out the left and right constraint when I'm using safe area. I kept getting, it was kind of weird because I was getting like an error, even though one of the examples I found looked pretty straightforward to me. And then the funny thing was once I got the safe area working on the thing, I had to comment out the left and right. And then of course, when I ran the app, the table view just didn't appear. So that's kind of my struggles.
Thing that has, I'm not exactly sure when that started happening, but it used to be if you had constraints wrong, it would just look kind of crazy when you're in the
app. Wonky, yeah.
Now most of the time it just doesn't show up at all, which is even worse. I guess it's a sign that something's wrong. It's a strong sign that something's wrong, but it also doesn't give you any clue about what's wrong.
Right.
Whereas it, get used to, you could look at it and say, oh, okay, it's just that one area that's wrong. So I can focus in on that and figure out what's wrong with my constraint.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like the idea of, you know, if there's some constraint that has to be violated, just slamming stuff into 0, 0 in the upper corner was kind of a nice way to like see that one, it's not invisible, because that could be a problem of like, oh, did I change the visibility on this? What, is there something else changed the visibility? What's happening? But having it not appear at all and not know that it's, you know, way off the screen somewhere is harder to debug than just shoving it in the wrong spot, like a clearly wrong spot, like upper left-hand corner or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so I think I'm looking at the code right now. I think I'm missing my top and bottom for a safe area. But yeah, it was weird trying to figure out, like, because of course, you know, if you're, I don't want to use the visual, was that visual language format where you sort of do the H and the pipes and the...
Yeah, that's been not recommended for a couple of years.
Yeah.
The layout anchors are pretty good. Now, if you have to do the stuff in code, the layout anchors are pretty good.
Yeah, that's what I'm using. I'm setting a layout margin guide.
Yeah.
And then using leading anchor, trailing anchor, top anchor, bottom anchor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I'm just looking at this. I just noticed that I don't have anything for top and bottom for the safe area part. Maybe that's what my problem was. Anyway, so I was talking to Tammy about this earlier too, and I just thought, why don't I just go and, you know, I do have actually a nib with where I created that little text view with a toolbar, sort of faux toolbar. I should just add a table view to that and be done with it, you know, and then I can, in the interface builder, set up the thing I need, right? So somebody's sending me some safe area documentation.
Mm-hmm. Wonder who.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I looked at this yesterday, this particular page too. We'll add this to the show notes. There's a thing called positioning content relative to safe area from Apple. Is there some code examples here? Oh yeah, there are. Okay, cool. Yeah, this is kind of sort of how I'm doing it, but okay. I'll have to give this a shot. Edge insets. Oh, interesting. UI edge insets mm-hmm. in the code. All right. Well, that's our bit of code for today. Well, there may be some more code later, but, you know, like we say, more than just code. All right. Speaking of code, hey, there's more code. The next post I have here, I saw this on a tweet from James Thompson, who, as we all know and love, anytime there's a new interface or new OS or new platform or whatever, he always takes a run at it with pCalc. So he posted a tweet the other day that he had there's a tool here by, I'm just remembering who the, I think Steve Stroughton Smith came up with this tool called Marzipanify. And so, you know, he kind of goes through this article that I've got posted here in his blog from High Caffeine Content about how, you know, Marzipan could work and the kind of things you have to do. And he starts listing off a bunch of bullet points on how to get it up and running. And then he just says, well, wait, hang on a second. Try this instead. And so he's introducing this tool called Marzipanify that basically lets you take your iOS app and build it for Mac. And of course, so James Thompson had a working copy or a video of a working copy of pCalc running on Mojave. So interesting tool. You guys have had a chance to look through this one at all, or looking at it now?
Yeah, it's interesting that there are folks who are out there reverse engineering and poking around to see how these things will work. Like the example there of the picker view and what it looks like on an iPhone versus what it would look like on a comparatively larger but still relatively small window on macOS. It's wild to see how these things, like I think I have some of the same sort of concerns that a lot of people online and other podcasts have mentioned of like, hey, these are not, you know, out of the box, they're not going to be great Mac apps. But I think I come at it from the angle of like, but at least they will exist, as opposed to what do you want? You want more Electron stuff? Do you like Slack? Do you want every app to be Slack or just a web page? I mean, this is a pretty decent way to get more stuff on there. And I think there's a whole class of apps that will benefit from a somewhat larger audience that never would have come to Mac, because they're not going to try to take on the omnis of the world who are like, you know, old hat and pretty professional at using both macOS and iOS. But the stumbling block to get on there for, as we mentioned earlier in the show, a comparatively smaller market wouldn't be there. And I think that's why people are using things like Electron. And I'm pretty excited for things like this. I mean, this is a workaround for whatever it is we're going to end up eventually getting officially from Apple. But it is pretty neat to sort of look at this and then see how it can be played with as terms of, you know, can I take my iPhone SE style view and make it somehow work on a big 6K video monitor that's rumored?
Yeah. I'm trying to find a link here. Where's the link to the GitHub? GitHub. I was looking at it earlier. Isn't this on GitHub or is it Panify? I notice he's got a screenshot from pCalc in here as well. Kind of funny. Yep, so that's something to look forward to if you want to get in there and play with it. All right. Oh, look, it's our favorite people, Facebook, again in this next story. This one's out of the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Yeah, this was on the news actually the other day too. Actually, on the March 3rd, which we're March 6th when we're recording here today, that what's the headline here? There's some documents have come to light that Facebook was planning to build a new development center here in Canada, and they basically wanted to come in here and have Canada stay hands off kind of thing on how they would handle data, right? Yeah, before we commit to opening a data center anywhere in the world, we want to make sure that we fully understand the country's laws, privacy protections, the company said in an email statement. This is not a threat to withhold investment on our part, but duty to protect people's data.
Yeah, I don't know how to solve that sort of thing. I mean, Facebook here is coming off kind of like a big bully, so it's not a very good look for them. Even if you assumed pretty good intentions, I think it'd be naive and silly to assume that there would be any sort of legally binding document that couldn't be pretty easily undone if a government entity wanted to change its mind. And I don't know how to solve the problem of, it's a hassle to deal with the legal aspects of data moved here to this particular server, and let's say it's in this particular country, like Canada, but it didn't move there because, this is related to a Canadian citizen. It moved because, storage unit number 537 is full, so we need to move this from, the South Korean data center over to the Canadian data center just to, distribute data evenly. And now it's like, now it's under the purview of Canadian laws. Like, well, I can understand it. I mean, that's sort of how other goods and services of the physical world work. But it seems kind of weird and silly in a network connected world. And I don't know how to solve that. I can't really argue against it per se and be like, oh, guess what? Facebook just and other cloud providers just, do the less efficient thing to deal with the fact that the United States and China and Russia and South Korea, apparently Canada, surely, Japan and everybody else, everybody wants to try to treat data as if it is sitting in the same area. And certainly we've seen countries like the United States have felt very strongly like, hey, Microsoft, you're an American company. Your Azure stuff that's sitting in Ireland, we have access to that through this legal rent. I don't agree with that personally, but I can understand the legal argument, and I don't know how to resolve that.
Well, they're probably sharding a lot of these databases, so they have multiple copies of all the data in different places just because it makes it easier and faster to access. If you have the same data in a design center in Seattle and another one in Toronto, well, if Tim needs to access something about that data, even though it's got something to do with Jaime, who's in Seattle, it'll be faster for him to access it there, from Toronto. So it avoids any kind of network congestion. It avoids outages at different sites. So I suspect that a lot of this data is in multiple places. They don't just keep stuff in the, for users in the U.S. They keep it all over the place. So I suspect this is somewhat preemptive to prevent some government from wanting access to all that data. I suspect it's probably not just Canada. It's any country where they would put a data center would have this kind of issue. I'm being a little optimistic optimistic about Facebook that they're not trying to be malicious here. But I get the feeling that it's just because they don't know where this data is going to be, so they don't want to have any kind of future problems with any government having interest in that data.
Right. It's kind of interesting. I thought of an analogy that goes back to the days of using DLT tapes. I don't know if you remember those, but the challenge is that every country is going to have its own data laws, and I think a little bit of the legislation that goes into laws around how data, we have different, we've had some weird bills here in Canada about internet privacy and whether you own something you download from the web, whether you have the legal right to have it or not. For a while there we had a rule where you could download, say like Game of Thrones from, the internet and put it onto your hard drive at home. And because you were doing it for your own personal consumption at the time, that was still considered legal in Canada. That law changed a few years ago, but to sort of be in parity with what's happening in the U.S. But you know, I used to have a customer that we used to have this large data center, this large sort of, it was like a silicon graphics, you know, storage where we would archive jobs to these DLT tapes, right? And, you know, we had this digital asset management system that would just, you know, we would just say, I want to take this particular project and I want to archive it. And it would go over to tape number one. And when tape number one is full, it would go to tape number two and so on and so forth. Right. And we had an issue where, a disk that was used to transport information between a client and our shop was delivered to the wrong client. Right. And that client got a bit upset about that. And they came to us and they said, we want to make sure that our data is not stored on the same DLT tape with our competitor, because we were dealing with, you know, companies that were considered, could be considered competitors. So we had to go through and restructure our whole data our whole data thing and create new policies for people. So we had, you know, customer number one would get written to these set of tapes and customer number two would get written to those set of tapes. And yet, you know, on the hard drives before we'd archive things on the hard drive, we have no idea where the data is actually being written on the drive, right? Not until we actually take it away and sort of put it into library mode and archive it that we were able to sort of segregate the data. And I think that's kind of sort of the same sort of thing, but on a much larger scale, that, you know, we can't, or Facebook or Google or Apple can't determine where, which drive anywhere in the world is going to store, you know, your resume or your photo of your kid, you know, right?
I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be impossible, but it's definitely a lot more engineering to make that segregatable. And then you'd have questions of like, how flexible is the segregation depending on what's happening? And then even if you think you got that right, then you've got bugs that could crop in. And then now you've accidentally violated what you thought was going to keep things nicely clean and separated.
Does that mean that you can only store Canadian Facebook data in Canada and you can only store, you know, Iowanian Facebook data in Iowa, California Facebook data in California? It kind of defeats the whole purpose of the global speed, right? Economies of scale and all that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I could think of is to have like internet-connected boats, data centers out there in international waters. Just like in our example, with you and I chat on Facebook, just like in the waters in between the United States and Canada, just like right there at the international border, but in the international waters area. Obviously, they can't do that, and I'm being facetious for other areas that like you wouldn't be able to bounce everything out there.
At the end of the day, borders, national borders, they're arbitrary, and you know, take Europe for example, they're constantly moving over there, right? So, you know, they've been pretty static here in North America, but I think there was a TED talk on how borders are just sort of, they're arbitrary lines in the sand, right? And data can't necessarily be, you know, you can't put a fence up in a data center, like on a drive and say, this partition is only for this country and that partition is for that country, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it comes back to like, you know, yeah, so, you know, I think Facebook felt, I guess, that Canada's rules or whatever weren't conducive to what they were prepared to do, I suppose, right? You know? All right. So, shall we move on to our picks?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right. So, coming back to Apollo 11, this is a cool little piece that I saw on Twitter. One of my favorite shows from the 90s. I'm trying to think, was this in the 90s or even the 80s when I used to watch this guy? This guy named James Burke, who's a British science journalist who had a show called Connections, which is an amazing show. I don't know if it's ever on.
Love that show. Sort of, I used to watch it all the time.
Yeah, so there's this cool video of him talking about how Wernher von Braun came up with the idea of mixing hydrogen and oxygen to create this amount of force to make a rocket leave the Earth. And I was watching another TED Talk the other day, thanks to Facebook, actually, where I find these TED Talks, ironically. they were talking about, you know, the size of the tank of fuel that you need, you know, dictates the size of the rocket engine. Oh, it was on PBS. It was a show on the Saturn V rocket and the engines they made for them. But the amount of fuel you put into the rocket, you know, you have to it takes a certain amount of energy to get, like, the larger the canister, the heavier the rocket, the further it's going to go. So there's this cool video here of him talking about how they finally figured out the ratio of hydrogen and oxygen to lift a Saturn V, which is, you know, I think 600 in the video, in the movie they talked about, or sorry, in the Apollo 11 movie, I think they said it was 600,000 pounds or something like that. It was like really effing heavy rocket, and it would take quite a bit of effort to get it up into space, right? Anyway, so this, in this clip, James Burke is walking beside the Saturn V, and then as he finishes his sentence, he goes, "You end up with something like this," and he points to the launch pad, and they blast off. It was a satellite rocket they were blasting off, but the timing of that whole clip is amazing. It's about a minute and a half long. Mm. There's a link here from Lionel Page on Twitter for the show notes, so take a look at that. It's really enjoyable.
How many takes do you think they had to do that?
Well, it's interesting that it looks like one take.
They can only do one take,
but there is a cut in the piece, right? I mean, the fact that he says, you know, the last little bit and then points to the rocket and blasts off, that he only had one chance to do that, right? Mm-hmm. But the other part where he's walking along and beside the Saturn V, he could have recorded that a number of times, right?
Yeah, I'm watching it now for the second time just to see if I can see where they cut it.
Yeah, there's so many amazing things I learned on that show, like where the color purple came from. Did you ever watch that one, Mark? Do you remember that story?
I don't remember that one.
So purple dye used to be really hard to make, right? And so that's why it was the color of kings, because it was, you know, it had to be, you know, practically royal to be able to afford it. Mm-hmm. So that's why kings had purple capes and things like that. And they were burning coal black in lamps, I think it was, right? And it would have this black residue that when the off gassing or the combustion would coat the glass, and they would have to clean it. And apparently one day somebody took the coal black and threw it into water, like in the river or whatever, and it turned purple. Mm. And that's how they figured out how they could use a mechanical method to make purple dye. Mm. And it came down in price.
So this show must have been on longer ago than I remember, because I'm looking at this clip from 1969, which is 50 years ago, and the guy looks pretty much exactly as I remember him looking in the show, maybe a little bit younger, but certainly not 40 years younger. So it must have been in the 80s or something.
Well, it must be, because, I mean, this is Florida, clearly, because that's where they have the Saturn V on its side. But the rocket that takes off, I mean, that could have been any time in you know, the whole space shuttle era, right?
Well, it says in the title of the tweet, it's covering live the Apollo 11 mission for the BBC.
Yeah.
But who knows? But it must have been late 60s, early 70s for sure.
Yeah. So, but if you step back, it comes from this Blue Dot company, Blue Dot Festival, which is celebrating the 50th anniversary. That's where that original clip is sourced from.
All right, I'm doing a Google search now.
All right.
Get some real-time follow-up here.
Oh, you're looking at Connections, James Burke?
Yeah. Original release, 1978. Wow.
No way. Really? Yep. Well, but we wouldn't have seen it in Canada or in the United States at that time. We would have probably seen it in repeats.
Probably,
right?
That's true. Yeah. Okay, he did three of them. He did Connections in 1978, Connections Squared in 1994, and then Connections Cubed in 1997. Definitely a break in between them, in between the first one and the second one, at least.
Yeah, they're great shows. Or 94. Hmm.
But still, the last one would have been 30 years after that clip. He didn't age too much, it doesn't look like.
Yeah.
Well, you know, probably if I watch it now, I'd be like, oh wow, he looks a lot older than I remember.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I thought it was, what episode did it say this clip was from? Well, you can buy it on DVD.
He said this wasn't from Connections. It said it was from, it didn't say it wasn't from Connections, but it just says he's covering live the Apollo 11 mission for the BBC. So it sounds like he was just doing it as a journalist.
But that wasn't Apollo 11 that blasted off. That's how I found it, was people were complaining that it wasn't Apollo 11.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the rocket, if you look at it, that's not a Saturn V rocket taken off, right? And I don't think that they didn't park the Saturn. I think that the Saturn rocket that's parked on its side in Florida was one of the ones from the canceled missions, right? Because they only did Apollo 17 was the last Apollo mission.
Hold on, I'm listening to what he's saying here. It says destination the moon.
Yeah, but if you listen, he says or Moscow. Peking.
Yeah, whatever that means.
So he's not specifically saying. Hmm. Anyway, we can argue about that forever. The next piece I have here is, I don't know if you heard, but our buddy Dave Abrams and a guy named Tony Elevato. Is that Elevato? Is he the guy who took over from Chris Lattner at Apple?
Don't know.
You guys
I'm not sure. I'm taking a his GitHub profile says he's a staff software engineer at Google.
Oh, Google,
In Kirkland, Washington, so.
Anyway, they've proposed a new tool for cleaning up or prettifying your Swift code called Swift-Format. And so they're proposing to release this tool. And there's a discussion about Apple making this become more standard. So, of course, Matt Triple T Thompson has written a piece on NS Hipster called Swift Code Formatters. And he goes through, he picks four Swift formatters that we may or may not be familiar with and runs them through the same piece of code and sees how it comes out and what it looks like. So Nick Lockwood's Swift format, Realm, who's produced Swift Lint, which is in use in a lot of different places. And there's a thing called Prettier with Swift plugin, which is a, I think a Java tool. And of course the proposed Swift format piece that Dave Abrams and Tony Alvialetto are behind. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if you guys had a chance to scan through this document.
I hadn't had a chance to read it prior. I'm scanning now, but I had seen some of the news headlines around people discussing this and like, is it the right time and other bits. I think my take on it is that assuming the formatter has some sort of pretty sensible adjustable defaults, and then you can customize based on your team's particular needs, I think it'd be great to have. I really would like to not have to worry about manually aligning things. Like, let me just write it as best I can and have the formatter correct it for me and make it pretty and easy to read.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like looking at the examples I've had a look at, I think that the which was the one I liked the best from a readability point of view. I like the way that they line up the vars and the things in the initializers, right?
Oh, that's kind of strange. For which that they, I'm looking at the which one is this? Oh, I see. Sorry. Okay, I was looking at the before and saying what?
Yeah. It's all weird. Like, right? I stepped out like that.
Yeah.
You don't have a stair step option in your right formatter.
Yeah.
So here's a question for you guys along the lines of formatting Swift code. Mm-hmm. So say you have an if let statement where the if part of it goes on to multiple lines before the, you know, before the squiggly bracket and the body of the if statement starts. How do you indent that?
So do you mean like you got if let blah 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 comma let blah 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 comma
let
blah blah blah
comma. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, do you indent, you line the lets up, the word let?
Well, the problem is that if you just use Xcode's regular hit return method, for aligning, what it does is it aligns the lets with the second lines of lets with the code inside the bracket.
Oh.
So it doesn't indent the code with respect to those lets. It does with respect to the first if, the first line of the if.
So if you do a comma and then are you putting a soft return in there or?
Yeah, you hit return after the comma.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then it lines it up with the beginning of the line or?
So you type your first if let statement,
right,
comma, right, hit return. It will indent the next let. Then you write a line, comma, hit return, another let. And then at the end of that one, you have the squiggly bracket, hit return.
Yeah,
it will align the inside the body of the if statement inside the squiggly bracket with one indent from the original if, which is the same position as all those other lets.
Right, right.
So if you're looking at it, it's hard to see that those lets are part of the original if statement as opposed to
right. Yeah.
You get used to it, but I always thought that was kind of a weirdness.
Yeah. This is the stuff that starts fisticuffs.
Yeah. I'm like an irrational champion and supporter of guard as a statement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I tried to tease out some of those into guards that, I really don't care about this. I'm just trying to make sure it's non-optional, right? And even if I have to do a couple different steps to get into what sets of things are non-optional, and then I can do an if let where even if it's two let pieces, it's fit within like the same line, on an 80 character width sort of imaginary boundary. I feel like that's a way you might be able to approach it. But if you really, really do have a bunch of lets in there that are required and you can't tease them out in any sensible fashion without making the problem worse for readability, I don't know that I really like that alignment that you're talking about. I feel like I would be a little confused. And it makes me wonder if some of this would be make some method calls or something. Because I don't know. You're right. The way that aligns, it would be difficult.
It's just a weird
to just see this thing is all related to this other thing without some fancy code coloring or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, my next pick here is, and this is from our friends over at Mac Stories, or is it Federico Verdici, or is it? Yes, it is. It's basically a shortcuts archive. So they've gone through and picked up a bunch of different archives or shortcuts and categorized them into different kind of things. So they've got App Store shortcuts, calendar shortcuts, email, Evernote files, JavaScript, Mac shortcuts, Markdown shortcuts, music, photos, task management. I'm just reading some of them, time tracking, weather, and then of course some miscellaneous ones. And these are examples that you can get if you do it on your iPhone. You can click on these links and load them right up into your shortcuts. You know, I'm looking at a weight tracker, so I use I downloaded the weight tracker one. A couple other ones I might take a look at are, of course, we've got the What's the Best Podcast one that we do, right, Jaime?
We do have it. I don't think it's on this list, but
I know
we do have one.
You know, compressed file, Dropbox files, attach them to an agenda, create a PDF, all kinds of different things. I don't know if you've seen any things you guys like.
It's a pretty big list. I'd have to really sit and read through that. Do you have any that you've picked up on and maybe even tried to use so far?
Well, I might try the glass of water one. That looks interesting because you want to, and it's like there's one here for logging the amount of coffee you drink, right? Mm. Check how much water you've drunk today. Video speed up. You want to speed up your video you're watching. Wake your Mac and log it in from your phone, from your watch, I guess, or from your phone, I guess. Publish to WordPress. There you go. There's one. I'm assuming these are shortcuts that people have added to their apps, hooks into the apps, right? Share Dropbox photo. Never going to use that one. Apple Frames, iOS only. What's this? Add device frames to screenshots. Oh, look at that. You can add different phone devices to your, if you have a screenshot. Mm-hmm. There's two of them here. Wait, there's one for Mac and one for iOS. I don't get it. That looks interesting though. OCR with Prismo Go.
Maybe there should be a shortcut for Marzipanify. It's like, what would my iPhone SE look like on a large 6K television or monitor? Right.
Yeah. Create Hyperlink. That'd be handy if I was publishing the podcast from my watch or my phone. Tweet songs, open Twitter app, get the weather report going there.
There's some sort of useless ones there. Well, useless to us at least. One called electricity price. Uses the common hour average electricity price API for Northern Illinois to return the average price of electricity for the current hour in US dollars.
Hmm.
Can't really imagine being that useful.
Like that one was bespoke to obviously folks in that region, but who were also doing cryptocurrency mining.
Mm.
Trying to turn on their mining materials when it was like, oh, look, it's cheapest right now between 2 and 5 a.m.
Mm. So here's one that totally fits to this program. Convert temperature between Fahrenheit and Celsius.
Mm, there you go. But how about miles per hour to kilometerage per hour?
I know, isn't that? Yeah, exactly. liters per miles, whatever, liter per kilometer.
Yeah.
Make PDF from Safari links. Start your work day. That's it. And if you're working from home, that may be handy. You could use your home kit to set your lights up and stuff like that. Oh. Yeah, I saw that electricity when you were just talking about it. Search Pocket. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So anyway, good selection. We'll have this link in the show notes for people. Mm-hmm. For those of you driving at home, right, Jaime?
Indeed.
And then, the last one is yours, Jaime.
Yeah, these are the conference videos for Serverside.Swift, which just took place, a little while ago in September of 2018 in Berlin, in Germany. But the videos are up there for the Serverside.Swift topics that were there, like, no surprise, Vapor and Katura on there. I might listen or watch this Swift's encoder and decoder protocols because I do mm-hmm. use those, mm-hmm. but it's kind of good to get a little refresher to make sure I'm not missing anything.
Yeah.
Looks like people have information on running small microservices in Swift on the production environments. So I'm very curious on people's experience with using that. Oh, look, there's even another one, Vapor in production, how to convince the client.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably the one that is the furthest afield from what I typically do, but looks very interesting from a hobbyist and enthusiast standpoint, is the Swift NIO on the Raspberry Pi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of curious how that works, that I don't know if it was a higher speed or a higher concurrency networking framework for Swift, the Swift NIO. I can't remember which it does, but it does networking gooder is the key thing to take away from that.
Right. Interesting. Cool.
Yeah, and just for completeness, because I see it on their website, if you are interested in the 2019 edition, it looks like you can save the date, October 30th through November 1st, not in Germany, this time in Copenhagen, Denmark.
Hmm.
So they're making their way around the European Union, I guess.
Around the globe. Going to be international like us.
That's true. Sometimes it's hard to think of it that way. You know, our cultures are so similar that it's hard to tell the difference at times. And then we'll run right up against a cultural barrier barrier wall that reminds us that we do sit on different sides of a line in the sand, as you described earlier.
That's true. Well, we're actually on three continents today.
It's true. No, we're not.
No, two continents.
Two continents.
Three countries. Crap. One hemisphere, two continents. Well, two continents. That's more than normal, right?
That's true.
That's true. True. That's true.
Yeah. More than just two continents. More than just one continent. All right. So I guess that's it for the week. So, hey, Mark, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Mark R. at smapsoft.com.
All right. And how would people get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as at Dev with the Hair.
So will you still be in Japan on Saturday?
Yes, I'm actually. Well, oh, wait, your Saturday? Yes, because I'm flying back on Sunday. So I will leave on Sunday from Japan and arrive in the United States on Sunday.
So if you hurry, you can probably catch Jaime in Tokyo.
if you're chilling in the Tokyo area, I have no idea what our listenership is like. But yeah, I leave kind of later in the evening on Sunday. So
provided I get this out on time too, right?
Or chit chat at Haneda Airport where I will be. We can meet up, and I would be very tickled pink, as they say, of like, oh my gosh, that'd be so crazy to run into a fan here in the Far East.
Did you bring any swag with you?
I do have t-shirts and stickers and pins that I brought to hand out at the conference. I guess if I have anything left over, I might be able to give stuff other than give the shirt off my back because I'm wearing the red key outline for the actual presentation on Saturday. Okay. Right. So if you don't mind it dirty, I might be able to give you that one. You can take it home and wash it or maybe not. Maybe it's like... We can recreate the Mean Joe Green Coca-Cola ad. Yeah. Where you give me a Coke and I toss you my jersey.
Right. Cool. All right. I guess until next week, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/MTJC. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
So how long have you been in Tokyo or in Japan?
Let's see here. It is Thursday here, and I've been here. I just arrived on Monday, so just a handful of days. Yeah, like 4 days.
So time check. What time is it there?
It is 12:42 p.m. on Thursday, March 7th, from my perspective. Okay.
Yeah, so you're in the future by about, I don't know, 10 hours maybe?
I think it's like 12. I always think of it as 12 plus like 2 to 4, I think.
Yeah,
that's what happened.
It's tomorrow already. You're ahead of me and Mark. We're behind you right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
I had to think really hard to say, okay, they've got this thing scheduled for the speakers. Is that going to conflict with recording? It definitely conflicts with Spotcast, but it's a different day than MTJC for me, so that worked out fine.
Well, what time are you? What time is? Because we record. We can record earlier for Spotcast because you're not here. But what? Because we don't record at the same time. It would be like 10 o'clock, I guess. Right.
Yeah, it's a little questionable because I'm like, well, where am I going to be out and about? And today in particular, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of tired. I'll snooze in a little bit, go to the local Lawson's convenience store, get this special karaage. It's basically like fried chicken, but chicken nuggets. Not like McDonald's chicken nuggets, but more like a tempura. If you've ever had that at a Japanese restaurant, that kind of like flakier, lighter thing.
And then it's like a tonkatsu kind of crust, chicken tonkatsu kind of thing?
It's not as bready with the panko style, but yeah, the flavor is more like that, but the texture, the lightness is more like tempura. So it's got, this had more more of a deeper flavor profile than you get with tempura. That makes sense. It felt more like a Japanese interpretation of American chicken nuggets is how I describe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, but just what's the name of the province or area you're in?
I'm in Nihonbashi.
So do you say Tokyo, Nihonbashi, Japan, or would you say Tokyo in the Nihonbashi region?
I think in the Nihonbashi region, and that might even be an hashtag ask MTJC if there's any listeners in Japan who can correct us.
Sure.
Okay. I don't think it's like a province. It's they do have like a thing that they call wards, and I don't know what wards are. I don't understand the term and how it differs. So that's why I just said like neighborhoods. Right? Like Seattle has neighborhoods like Fremont and Belltown and South Lake Union where Amazon is.
Tenderloin, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And Toronto has those as well, I'm sure. And the Bay Area definitely has those, depending where you're talking about. So
close thing. Tokyo is just so enormously huge that these neighborhoods, if you want to call them, are pretty big. They're like almost cities unto themselves.
Yeah, and it's so different. So I mentioned I'm in what I believe to be a central business district area because there's a lot of tall office towers. The people I see walking around are decked out pretty nicely, very professionally. Nothing other than the convenience stores and a handful of like tiny mom and pop noodle shops. Nothing opens up before 11. It's like clearly meant for lunchtime. Really? People come out and then it is dead at like 5 or 6 p.m. when they get out and people go elsewhere to drink, I would guess. Mm-hmm. And it's also, it just feels more businessy, if that makes sense. You don't see like a whole lot of uniqueness. It's like, yeah, everybody kind of has like a work uniform, Wall Street style sort of thing. And it's completely different than if you go to like Shibuya, where there's tons of tourists. If you go to Harajuku, which is pretty famous for the weird teenage fashion sort of stuff. And that there is completely overwhelmed with teenagers. It was shocking how different it was. Like, I don't know that I saw any adults for like the longest time. It was very kind of concerning. Like I would be like on a government watch list in the United States if I went to this area sort of thing.
Have you checked out Akihabara yet?
Yeah, that one was definitely on my list. And it's not that far. It's pretty close to where I'm at. Close. It's like one or two train stops. And it's just like every anime, manga sort of thing you've ever thought of or ever could conceive of exists there. And even a whole bunch of Western toy product type stuff is there. Like I took pictures of some Star Trek Enterprise stuff, like a model kit that's there. There's like these little weird heads. I don't even know what they are. They look like tiny little statue quality, but like they were 3D printed or like they're made to go on like a type of Barbie doll sort of plastic that are celebrities. Like I was like, oh, that's Wesley Snipes. That's Josh Brolin. You know, it's like,
oh, really? Wow.
This other dude who I don't recognize, but he's from that one movie of where he's the lawyer or PR person for the big smoking executive companies. I'm like, I don't know that dude's name, but I totally recognize him.
Oh, the guy from The Dark Knight.
Yes, he was. It was
Two-Face,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Aaron something.
Anyway, doesn't matter.
Yeah, we can do some fact check on that one. And then they also had a whole bunch of what I assume are used products of like things that came out of vending machines, or in some cases things that were from the West, like little Star Trek Enterprise put together plastic toys, like an Enterprise D that like separates not just saucer separation, but it also like the engines come off and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Should I get these? And I was like, holy smokes, $2,000. That's like $20. Dude, this thing is like 3 inches at best. It's not a very large sort of thing, but I guess if you wanted to corner the market on, remember those first Star Wars toys, not the original 70s ones, but the ones that came back in the 90s when the special edition were about to come out for the original trilogy.
Yeah.
They have like all of those from what I can tell. So I feel like you could come corner the market, just buy them all for an absurd amount of money and then just put them in an underground cavern in Nevada or something and just wait out, you know, like people dying off or losing these things.
Well, those things show up in we have our fan expo here. They show up there. Like if you go to some of the booths, you'll see like, you know, you see the North American Star Wars or Hasbro swag or whatever, but you'll also see these really intricate, detailed, slightly different scale Star Wars stuff that are definitely from Japan. And of course, course, they're marked up like gazillion dollars, whatever. I was going to say, like, could you just stock up on stuff, like, while you're there, like swag and toys and things like that?
Yeah, there's even, like, some sort of duty-free tax system that if you, like, collect a whole bunch of stuff and it doesn't include consumables, like, you know, candies and things, you can somehow export these things tax-free. And it's weird. I didn't understand the system. It seems like it involves handing it off to somebody else, and maybe they make the purchase. I'm not really sure.
Like a brokerage?
Yeah, whatever. I'm not sure how it works. And just given my almost complete lack of understanding of Japanese, both written and spoken, it's been very weird for me coming to a country where I can speak at like the level of like an 8-month old child, and I'm effectively illiterate, except for the saving grace that there sometimes is a little bit of English, and at the very least, they use the same numerals that we do, so I can understand how much something costs.
How are you dealing with signage and stuff like that? Is there like any English at all, or is it all just to learn it?
Well, for the subway system, which is outstanding, like I have a hard time believing anybody in the world has something better than this, because here I am coming in, I don't speak the language, I don't know the areas. There is signage in both Japanese and English, but everything is very patternized and regularized, where I can say, okay, these sorts of signs tell me where the exits are. These sorts of signs tell me where the different lines are. And the lines have very specific names. They have very specific colors. They also have stop number designations, like this is the Ginza line. You're on G11, and where you're trying to get to is G7. So, okay, just do the math. That's how many spots that you need to go. And you just need to make sure you get on the correct platform. You're not going in the wrong direction.
Well, I'll give you a tip, though. That's definitely true in the bigger stations, and especially if you're on the Japan Railroad, which is the main ring around the city that kind of goes everywhere. That's absolutely true. But I don't know if you've discovered this, and maybe other people don't know, but Tokyo is kind of interesting because there's not just one subway. There's multiple subway lines, and many of them are privately owned. So the main one is a government run one. That's the Japan Railroad. But there's other ones, smaller ones, that just go to one little part of the city that are privately owned, interestingly enough. And sometimes the only way to get to a certain place is to get off the main subway and take one of these smaller subways. And I found out the hard way that when you do that and you go to some of the smaller stations, all of a sudden there's no English anymore.
Yeah, that would be Johnny for sure. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that part of it, because it feels, I haven't gone to the places you just described, but it feels so seamless in terms of getting around, because I'm pretty sure I have gone on some of the private lines. I have seen some that were definitely JR, but some other ones that I believe were smaller private lines.
Yeah.
And it pretty much didn't matter to me, because I'm using the Suica card. There's also Pasmo as like a reloadable card. And I was wise enough to add that to my Apple Wallet. So it can be reloaded via Apple Pay. So, you know, from the toilet or in a restaurant or, you know, just on the street corner, I can just add more money if I need it. And it has a transit mode that I did not know existed for anything, because I don't have anything like that in the U.S. is it assumes that you don't want to use Face ID or Touch ID, and that you're just going to tap at the terminal. So it's just like tap, it reads the NFC chip, and then just like walk through it. It gives me a little happy ding sign.
And well, it's been a long time since I've been there. And to tell you how long it's been, I don't even own a smartphone, I don't think, last time I was in Japan. So things may have changed quite a bit, for sure.
Yeah, I think you would.
And you know what? Now that I think about it, with an iPhone and Google Maps or whatever, or whatever you have, it would probably be relatively simple to figure out where you are at any given time.
Okay, let's come back to that one, because I have strong opinions about that. And you're right, it has been helpful. So the Apple Pay and Apple Wallet thing is interesting, because the Suica card, like, you have to buy like a physical one to start with, unless you do like their app, but their app is not translated into English, even though it's available in the US store. I didn't want to go that route, so I went to go, you know, buy a physical card, and then you just add the card to your wallet through like normal wallet stuff, and it transfers the value by holding the card against the phone for like 15 seconds. It's so slick, and it's interesting that there are so many different shops and vendors and even vending machines that you can use the Suica on your iPhone to just pay for stuff. So when I'm cash, I use Suica as much as possible. Now, when it comes to getting around, you're right, Google Maps is super helpful to show you like where you're at, you know, in the region roughly. And it is pretty good at transit directions, like way better than Apple Maps. Like Apple Maps would say, like, like, oh, like get on this line, go to this station. And Google goes further and says, go in through entrance B1, exit out of Charlie 12 on the other end. So it's not like a huge difference, it seems, but it's such a nice quality of life thing to not have to guess, like, all right, if I go the wrong direction, that I just cost myself another 5 to 10 minutes of walking back the other way once I get out. But the location for GPS has been annoying me, and I don't know what to blame. So I'm normally using Verizon. I'm paying for their little travel pass thing to use my normal data plan while I'm here, so I don't get bankrupted by the data charges for international roaming. And it's roaming with Docomo, which their name is a pun, Docomo, which means, everywhere, kind of implying like, hey, like their coverage is everywhere. I know just enough Japanese to call it Dokodaka, which is where is it? As in, where the hell am I? Because I would stand in a street corner and watch my little blue dot shift 100 meters in one direction and then jump maybe 20 meters in another. And I had no clue. I got so lost the first day or two because I thought, oh, I'm heading in this direction. And I didn't know where I was. So I've ended up using the maps as a sort of like, all right, generally, this is where I want to go, like the area that's around me. And then I use the blue dots arrow to figure out which direction am I facing, because at least the compass works flawlessly. So I say, all right, I'm getting out of this station here and it's roughly northeast from where I'm at. So just continue walking, face northeast and then continue walking that direction until I see some landmarks or something that show up on Google Maps. I have no idea. I have no idea how it was so weird getting accustomed to, this doesn't work as magically as it does for me in the United States. And I don't know if that's because of weirdo mobile network problems here in Japan or if it's somehow related to, American iPhones don't have the right sort of radios that are slightly different from compatibility with Japanese networks or something. I'd have to maybe get somebody and be like, hey, stand here with your Japanese iPhone, let's show a route and let's see where it takes us, sort of thing, and compare and contrast.
Right. Well, so I'm just looking at a map of Tokyo just before we get started on the show, because we should record a podcast.
This is the podcast.
I know. I'm going to use a lot of this stuff.
More than just goofing into the after show.
So is there like a major, like I'm looking at the map here and I can't find the region you're talking about, but is there like a major landmark near you somewhere?
You see the big green thing right in the middle of Tokyo?
The Imperial Palace?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty much right by where he is.
Really?
I think. Right down there? Isn't that right, Hami?
Imperial Palace. No, here, well, I guess it depends what map you're looking at. Are you looking at Google Maps so I can look at the same thing?
I'm looking at Apple Maps.
All right, let me fire up Apple Maps.
Yeah, I see it right here. So you're near Kanda Station, right?
Kanda Station. Let me see. I don't...
Shinnihonbashi?
So,
in between Tokyo Station and Kanda Station?
Tokyo Station and Kanda. I know I definitely have walked past Kanda. So Kanda is to the north of Nihonbashi, and Ginza, or maybe Shinbashi, because it looks like it's a little larger on here, is to the south of me.
Oh, okay. Okay, a little bit further south.
I found Nihonbashi here on, it's the Tokyo train station, I guess.
Yeah. So the Imperial Palace is kind of the big green area right to the west of Tokyo Station.
Right, yeah, and he's east of that. Right?
You're just east of that, yeah.
Yeah, I see like a little signpost here. You zoom in a bit more. Yeah, I see Nihonbashi here is one word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Near the Pokemon Center.
Yeah, I actually did go to the Pokemon Center DX. Imperial Palace looks close, but that's just because how large that area is.
Mm.
It's really not that close, I would have to take the lines to get there.
Yep.
All right, this is a screenshot for the show.
So where I used to stay when I've been at Tokyo twice, and both times I stayed in Shinagawa, which is a little bit south, kind of follow the water down south, and it's kind of right down there.
So it says 11 degrees on the map. I guess that's what the temperature is there. Celsius.
Yes, 51 degrees Fahrenheit, according to my Apple Watch.
Right. Cool. But you're still in the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Yes.
All right. It's hit cold here. It's crazy cold.
Yeah, it's been cold here.
Yeah?
Cold and rainy.
Mm.
I saw in very sad news today, I saw in my Twitter feed that Alex Trebek has pancreatic cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Stage 4 in... He put out a YouTube video. It's like a minute and a half where he said, in continuing with his being very open and transparent about his life, and because he didn't want news to leak out there and then get overblown. He's like, odds are bad, but I'm going to fight this. And then he even makes a little joke at the end on that his contract requires him to be there for another 3 years. So he's going to at least do that. So kind of a dark moment there, but
yeah. I guess Joe Perry, right? Or is it Joe Perry or
Luke Perry? Yeah. From 90210. Yeah. And it's crazy because they were just talking about having some sort of 90210 reunion special, I think, like, mm-hmm. like 5 or 6 episodes on Netflix or some other streaming channel, I think.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
More crazy because he's only a year older than I am.
Yeah, I didn't see the specific news. Did they describe, like, did he
have a stroke?
Yes, I understand, like, how he died, but was it, like, oh, random freak accident, or, like, oh, yeah, you know, it turns out his family has a history of strokes or heart disease or some other, like, genetic type thing, or...
Yeah, hard to say.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
My body is breaking down here as I normally live a very relatively sedentary lifestyle working from home, just walking around everywhere here.
Yeah.
And my left ankle was really hurting me, so I went to the convenience store to buy some wrap and just wrap my ankle like an athletic injury.
Sure, yeah.
So we'll see how that goes today.
Do they have like proper pharmacies and stuff there?
Of course they do.
As far as I could tell,
they're civilized country, Tim.
Yeah, but I mean, you have Walgreens and we have Shoppers Drug Mart and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're just stores I've never heard of. You know, and limited access to English. I just kind of looked for pictures of, like, all right, this is a thing that you would wrap around your hands. I can use that around my ankles too.
Right. Okay. This might work today. Who knows? I'm just playing with these layout anchors again. Nope. Still getting undeclared guide. Oh, guide. Wait, what the heck?
Yeah. I do feel like with the layout anchors and stack views, you pretty much have what you need for layout that would mostly, and maybe even in all cases, take over the visual format language you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of what would be easier to do that would be worth giving up the compiler helping you out.
Right.
I'm sure there's something that I haven't thought about. Like, there isn't like a one true answer to auto layout, but I'm struggling to think what it is.
But now that I'm looking at this again from today, I see what I did wrong yesterday. I was a bit punchy when I got to this part. See what happens. Maybe if I get a view, I'll be happy.
Well, the nice thing about using Interface Builder is you can see right in the screen if there's something wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It tells you that there's, you know, with the red markers that some constraints are conflicting or aren't set.
Well, I'm getting the red markers in code here, but... they're actually errors. But, and I've got that reveal engine running on this Mac still. So if I want to go look at the layout, I can look at... And I can tweak things. I can move them around. And that's what I like about reveal as opposed to the visual debugger. Can you move things in...
No, you can't.
Visual debugger?
Visual debugger is nice, but it is kind of limited with what you can do.
Static, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the problem was I was actually crashing. Mm-hmm. Let's see if it works today. Like, I was getting... that lib C++ error. Oh, I got a table.
Woo-hoo. Oh, the lib C++ error is, I've seen that often if you have a constraint set to a negative number, like a width or a height constraint. So if you're calculating the width or the height of something and setting the constraint in code, and you happen to get a negative number for some reason, then the app will crash.
Hmm.
It didn't used to do that for iOS 12, but it does now in iOS 12 very repeatedly.
Well, it worked. I got the whole thing, but I've lost my toolbar because I'm overriding it. How do I set a constraint against that? But at least I figured out what the syntax error I was dealing with was yesterday. Small things.
Yep.
All right. Well, anyway, I got to get going because it's late here. What time is it there? It's 2 o'clock, honey?
Yeah, 2:20. Not late here at all. If you want to go for another 5 hours, let's do it.
Funny, yeah. Oh, that's what I wanted to ask you. So can you actually get Spotcast? Or sorry, can you actually get CBS All Access out there or Netflix or something?
That's a good question. Netflix looked weird to me, and I wonder if it is because I'm attaching through the hotel Wi-Fi or just because of where it picks up my region. Oh, I do actually have my region set to Japan because that was the only way to add the Suica card to my Apple Wallet. So I don't actually know for certain. I was very disappointed in YouTube TV that it full-on doesn't allow me to see a damn thing. So I'm like, oh,
right.
I wanted to watch this week's episode of Supergirl. I wonder if I can do it from the CW website or something. So I don't actually know for certain. I'll have to try that out and see if I can even watch the episode.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering, like,
So we can do some real-time investigation here. Let me see. Let me fire up that good old CBS All Access app. I mean, we were just talking about data and you know, invisible lines in the sand. This is one of the sillier ones. Oh, due to licensing restrictions, video is not available outside your country.
Right, yeah.
I probably can. Oh, I wonder if I can watch it in Netflix then. It's basically free everywhere else in the world.
So when I'm in the States and I log into Netflix, I get American Netflix, not Canadian Netflix.
Ooh, let's see here.
Because I remember I watched some movie, some Rolling Stones movie when I was down in Denver once, and it wasn't available here in Canada until like 6 months later.
Oh, Star Trek Discovery, new episode weekly. Can I actually watch? Oh, is this what it looks like at Netflix? Light and Shadow. Let me see if I can watch the episode. I apologize if it comes out on the air. Mm-hmm. No spoilers for Mark, so I'll try not to do show anything here. Oh, yeah, I can. Oh, okay. Forget CBS All Access. Watching it on Netflix like the rest of the world. I'm wondering
what time it would be available to you. Like, would it be on at 5 p.m. or, 8 p.m. tomorrow night, tonight, I guess, for you, right? Because you're 10 hours or whatever ahead of us?
That's a good question. I don't know if they release it everywhere at the same time. Like, I basically in the United States, it comes out at the same time as you guys, I think, right? Isn't it kind of late, like 8 p.m. or something when it comes out for you guys?
Yeah, 8 p.m., yeah. Okay. What time is it available for you?
Like 5. It's not immediately available. It seems like it's like 10 minutes delayed before the magic caching mechanism unlocks and I can see the episode show up. And some nights, other than others, I'll be a little bit more worried about recording at the same time sort of thing. But so if it's 5 p.m. on Thursday, and it's Wednesday over there right now, right?
Right.
Thursday. So then add 12, it'll be 5 a.m. and then another like 3 to 4, like 8 in the morning. Might be able to watch an episode on. Oh, no, you know what? Friday morning, there might be a speaker thing. So I don't know. Probably not at the same time you guys do.
Hmm.
Yeah, but we'll see. Talk about, we were just talking about storing people's private information and the difficulties with an internet connected world and invisible lines in the sand. And here I am running into I'm a U.S. person. You know, I'm paying for this. Why don't you just let me watch this regardless of where I'm at? Why does it matter that I happen, like, it's on my same device, for heaven's sake? It's not like I handed my credentials to somebody else.
Yeah, but your computer could have been stolen and taken to Japan with your Apple Watch.
I mean, that's entirely possible, but it seemed like a very around the world and a not very straightforward sort of way to get to your content fix. And I in terms of ad targeting, it's funny to see, watching a little bit of YouTube, and I'm like, come on, Google. Yes, I happen to be physically sitting in Japan right now, but I'm logged in as myself, and you could probably surmise that I don't speak Japanese, just given how often I ask Chrome to translate a page for me. Yeah. Why are you giving me Japanese only, no English whatsoever ads? It's like you're completely wasting everybody's time and money by showing me this. Well, on that delightful note, I will see you guys next time.
Yeah, or all talk right. to us next time.
Have fun mm-hmm. conference.
All right, thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.